Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them.
This is the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I gave it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful.
No yelling on the bus.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight familiar, your butt at the party.
And Jake Latondras.
I am bad news.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet this guy's into the woods $100.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, didn't say it.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
Showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line podcast. I'm Rocky LaFleur in the Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi. Joining me all the way out in Kansas, Ryan Warden. Ryan, man, last week's episode, man, it's running neck and neck with Foles.
Well, that's good. Good for you, right?
No.
Good for me, too. Good for me too.
Yeah,
that means we're educating some people. Hopefully, somebody's learning something.
Man, and there's a lot of comments, a lot of people waiting on this episode. But last week when we ended it, I said I wanted to get into who you were, how you were raised. You know, what kind of, because my belief is we are the foundation that is instilled in us as a kid. And our mothers and fathers put those foundations in us, whether good or bad. I'm not trying to put you on the couch here and play psychiatrist. Tell me about who you were as a kid, and then we'll talk about how you got into hunting.
Well, I think I was a pretty average kid. I grew up in a small town out in western Kansas. It was Deerfield, Kansas. There was one paved road there. Everything was kind of centrally located about 4 blocks from the swimming pool. I spent a lot of time at the swimming pool. And the Methodist Church was about 2 blocks from our house. Actually, it was 1 block from our house. So I spent a lot of time there. My mom was very active in the church, and so was I. My dad was very, very, very active, what I would call a woodsman. Anything in the field, hunting-wise or fishing-wise, we took trips to Colorado, to Mirror Lake and Taylor Reservoir, and fished all around Pitkin and everything. We were kind of always on the go. Went up to Jackson Hole, Wyoming, caught cutthroat trout. Anything we could do outdoors, my dad was doing it, and he was, I'd like to think he wasn't forced to drag me along because my mom wasn't like that, but I was the only boy. I had two sisters. So I kind of went a lot, got to do a lot of different things. My dad was active in trapping. So I learned at a really young age to run a trap line with him. I used to go before school and check traps. Had an old 76 Ford truck with a spotlight or his side, right above his side mirror, and we'd go check the trap line, and it was always really exciting to see what we had, and real interesting when we came across the skunk, and we tried every method there was to dispatch the skunk and where it wouldn't spray, from talking to it to shooting it in a certain spot and whatever. And so, I grew up under my dad's wing as a woodsman, and we had annual pheasant hunts and waterfowl hunts and I mean, just any chance we could be to be out in the woods, we were out in the woods doing something. Did a lot of waterfowl. I really, really liked that. I liked the foggy mornings and hearing the wings whistle through the air, and then all of a sudden, you know, 35 teal would break through the fog, you know, 50 yards in front of you, and maple leaf into the pond while three adults missed and one kid jumped out of his skin with excitement. So I think it was probably a very, very good childhood. I got to experience a lot of things and do a lot of different things. And most of that was from my mom and dad. My mom driving me around and my dad taking me around as well. I went to middle school and loved hunting. My dad would take me out of school. Opening day of deer season, it always fell on a Wednesday for rifle season. He would take me out of school, and we would go deer hunting. That was a tradition that we always had, and it was great, and we continued that tradition forever. And same with opening weekend of pheasant season, hunting during those times. And even when I went away to college, I always came back and hunted with my dad and those guys. It was just, there were just great memories of things. And there was times where my dad, especially around November and December, my dad wouldn't get off work in time to hunt the evening flight of waterfowl. And I was about 14 or so. And so my mom had a four-door Grand Marquis. And I could fit two shells in the back of it. And one of them I'd lay over my chest with the gunny sack that held them across my feet. I had a wooden Loman call for a long time, and then it was a Big River honker. I worked at it and worked at it and worked at it. And I think when I was 14, I killed 13 geese that year. I was pretty excited since I was kind of a solo hunter. Sometimes my mom would go with me and sit off and read a magazine or something while I was out in the field or whatever, but I hunted mainly by myself. And then as I became freshman, let me ask you this.
One of the things that you and I share in common is, and it comes up in conversation outside of this podcast, we talk about it all the time, doing the right thing. You know, when you were coming up hunting with your dad, hunting with his friends, did most of those guys follow the law? I mean, because what you see in those who mentor you is who you become in hunting.
Yes. I can't think of any laws that my dad or the guys we hunted with ever violated. Nothing intentional anyways. I think to a certain degree there was probably party hunting that went on, especially like with waterfowl. I think that's probably very common these days even. So I never put a lot of weight into that type of stuff. He never not tagged stuff or did anything that he wasn't supposed to that I saw. I mean, we had several run-ins with the game wardens. And the game warden was Bruce Peters. He was from Western Kansas. He was a great guy. I always looked up to him. He was a goose hunter himself, shot a single shot 10 gauge. I didn't really like him stopping us at the time.
He walked around with a limp in the shoulder.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I just never was around anything that really went on wrong. But you know, we got into high school.
Before you get into high school, what about this? Let me ask you just this. If one of them sticks out in your mind, do you remember your first goose or first duck? Which one of them sticks out in your mind the most and why?
My first goose. It was a big, big, big Canada goose. I had it mounted. I still have it today. I was 14 years old. There was a gentleman that had I would call it a cornered market on the geese. I might have been 13. I still got the picture. I'd have to ask my dad. I would say 13. Was begging my dad to take me. My dad said, you know, I can, but I have a hard time getting off. We can do it on the weekend. They're going on Ron Petz's. And I said, okay. And he said, Ron doesn't let many people hunt, Ryan. I'll talk to Ron and see what he says. And I said, okay. And I didn't know any better. I didn't realize that Ron Petz didn't really let anybody hunt at all. And so my dad asked him, and Ron said, of course, I'll take him. And so me and Ron went out, and I had no idea what to experience. And we went out, and I think he was probably a busy farmer that didn't really have a bunch of time for me, but made some time for me. And he owned a bunch of agriculture ground that surrounded the lake. And in western Kansas, when you have a lake with water in it, that's a rare thing. You may not find water for another 100 miles or 200 miles. So I remember going with Mr. Petz. He was driving an old Dodge pickup at the time. We were at the south end of a lake called Lake McKinney. The weather was kind of bad. And he said, they're going to fly low coming back across here, and we're going to pick out one of these greater geese, one of these bigger geese, and we're going to shoot them. And I said, okay. And so it wasn't a formal decoying, traditional decoying deal. It was more of a pass shoot. Was exactly what it was. And it wasn't sky busting. He called it. They came across there low, because they'd never had any pressure. I mean, they were, I don't know, 10 yards high, maybe 15 yards high. They were flying back into the wind. And we were out there set up, and he said, wait till I say go. And when I say go, set up, Ryan, and pick the biggest one you can out and shoot it. And he said, shoot all three times at it. Don't just shoot it once. Shoot all three times at it. And I said, okay. And I had my dad was a member of the trap shooting club that was actually about 4 miles, probably about 2 miles from where we were hunting. And I'd shot trap forever, had a 870 youth model gun. And I said, okay. And we got there, and I had a 3-inch load. You could still shoot lead at the time. I had 3-inch fours in. And he said, go. And I lifted my head up, and I will never forget. They were right there, so close, so big. I picked the closest one to me. I'm not sure if it was the biggest one or not, but it ended up being a big. You know, at the time, the story was about 16 pounds was what the story was. But, you know, the number of geese that I've harvested over the years, I would say the goose was probably closer to 13 or 14. But it was a fish story for me. So it was every bit of 16 at that time. And shot the first round. And I hit him, and I shot the second round, and I missed. and he was still flying. I shot the third round and busted his wing. And at that point, I was educated on aiming, shooting them in the head and leading them and whatever. And he talked to me about trap, and it was a great experience. He brought me home. I took pictures with it. It was probably the most exciting thing ever. I've since then hunted with his grandkids, taken them out, and tried to repay that favor, but I don't think I ever could. It was probably one of the most special moments there was.
You were going into high school. You were about to go into that before I interrupted you.
No, that's fine. Yeah, I was. So we started high school. There was a pretty close group of us friends. Clayton, Chris Gillen, Clayton Tarpley, Ryan Schiffelbar, and me. We were all pretty close. Close buddies and good hunters. or we thought we were good hunters at the time. And we spent a lot of time together. And so we all elected to take weights first hour. And the benefit to that was school was going to start at 8 o'clock. And the birds would land just on the east side of Lakin. I lived in Deerfield, and I drove 8 miles to go to school at Lakin every day. And so we would go a little bit early, and we would set up, and we could get into a flight or two of them before we had to bail out and go to school. And I asked for some full bodies that year, and decoys were becoming a big thing. The full body decoy was becoming a big thing, and Bigfoot, Clinton decoys, they were leading the industry at that point. And so I asked for 6 Bigfoot for Christmas. I got them for Christmas. And we put those out with the shells, and we laid under the shells, and we could kill 2 geese apiece at that point. And we did pretty well and had a lot of fun. And we would shoot the 2 geese, and then about a block from the school, Chris, my buddy Chris, his grandma and grandpa lived there, and they were woodsmen, both of them. So they were fine with us dropping the geese off in their garage. And then at lunchtime, we would come back and clean the geese and, you know, package them, throw them in the freezer, eat a sandwich real quick, and then go back to school. And so we spent anything outside of football season, especially in late, you know, December and January, that was kind of a pretty regular thing for us.
Sports? Did you guys get involved in sports?
Did. Played, we didn't have, we had kind of limited sports where I was at. We had, we didn't have baseball at the time. In the spring, your options were golf or track. And I was not going to run track. Not the skinniest guy in the world. But definitely did not want to run in circles.
Basketball, as surprising as it is, man, basketball, I don't guess it is to the people that know basketball, because Kansas is always in the Final Four. But, man, everybody I talk to from Kansas is huge into basketball, no matter what kind of athletic shape they're in.
Yes, I've played basketball, but not for our school, because there were 6 guys in my class that were very dominant at basketball. Chris, the guy Chris I was talking about earlier, was one of them. me and Clayton were not. Clayton was one of the fastest two in the school, but we were not. We weren't shooters like these other guys were, and we didn't have the height that they had. So we were the fan club. We were the obnoxious cheering section that traveled to the away games and let everybody know that we were there, type of deal. But football, we played football. We all played football.
Well, you said golf. I can't imagine a golf course being that difficult in Kansas. It would make for a pretty course, but about the only way you could make it tough is make it long. There's no trees.
Yeah, there's no trees, especially in western Kansas. There's definitely not any trees. But inevitably, if they put one out on the golf course somewhere, I assume that I found it. And I used to think they were 90% air, but my ball never made it through, or seldom, it seemed like. So.
Well, you and I could ride the cart together.
Well, I ended up on the option for a football scholarship to Hutch JUCO or a golf scholarship, and I ended up golfing. I went in the weight room one day and met some guys from Orlando, Florida area. And I thought, no, I don't think that's looks very fun to get hit by that guy. So I think I'm going to go with option number two. So I did. I went to school in golf for 2 years. So kind of funny that you talk about basketball, but I could shoot, but it was ugly.
You could have been a hacker. You could have signed up and been a hacker.
Well, it's kind of funny because that's when the whole cable guy stuff came out and prison rules, and we used to, especially me and Clayton, because we weren't as athletic as our buddies. And so we kind of roughhoused them a little bit when they would get in the lane. We'd kind of wait for them, maybe give them a clothesline or take their feet out when they jump. So we were rough on them sometimes, but they all lived.
Well, back to the hunting. So, look, everybody knows where your future's going. You're going to be a guide, an outfitter later on. You really had to, with being a goose guide and a duck guide, you really had to work on your calling. Who was your mentor when it came to calling? Where did you really get into getting a pretty good caller?
Well, there was nothing at first. And in western Kansas, there's nothing. And so obviously went through college, wasn't guiding yet, got done with college. And in about 1999 to 2000, Mike Keller, Big Guy's Best, he was coming to Kerwin a lot, and he was hunting with another friend of mine that I hunted with once in a while, Chad Rohr, and I got invited to go, and me and Mike Keller, he had cystic fibrosis and wasn't in great shape, but him and his dad came, and he called, and his dad would shoot, and I was obviously shooting. And was sitting in a blind next to him, and to this day, he was probably one of the goosiest sounding guys I've heard. And that really drove me to start calling a lot. He gave me a goose call. It was his Big Guy's Best, all smoke, and he gave me a duck call, and it was his bourbon and water duck call, and basically said, when I come back, you can help me call. And we hunted a few other times together before he passed away. And when he did, Jeff took over his calls. And I've never asked Jeff this, but I think this was the case. I think he was initially making the guts for Foyle's calls, the tone boards and the wedges. I don't know that for sure, so don't hold me to that. Sorry, Jeff, if you're listening, that's not right. But I think that was the case, and so they had a good relationship there. And then I was in college and started working at a sporting goods store in Hayes, Kansas, and we were hunting a bunch around Kerwin. It was a federal refuge north where we were hunting with Mike, and was sitting there at work one night. We stayed open late. It was January time period probably, and phone rings to the store. We were carrying Foyle's calls at the time. Phone rings to the store. I pick up the phone. I had dealt with Jeff and his wife at the time over the phone on orders, mostly his wife, and picked up the phone and said, "Outdoor Edge, this is Ryan. How can I help you?" And he said, "Hey, Ryan, this is Jeff Foyle's." And he said, "We're on our way back from calling competition at the sports warehouse in Loveland, Colorado, and we need a little bit more footage for Fallen Skies 2. And so do you guys have tags, and, you know, can you get us set up to hunt tomorrow?"
It's got to be a big deal. Yeah.
It was, and they were asking me what was around there. They had already had a connection with Bob Goodrow. And so I ended up getting to go along with them and do everything, and was kind of a partial host. It was kind of my 15 minutes of fame that was early. And we went out to dinner that night at 8. The next morning went out, shot a limit of geese before 9, went and ate breakfast. Everything was good. Jeff had no idea of anything that was going on. I had no idea anything that was going on with him. Everything seemed normal at the time.
And this is a lot of people that's listening to this are younger and have lived in the internet age, you know, post, say, 05, that are listening to this. But, man, back in you're talking about 99, 2000, that time frame, man.
Yeah, 2000, 2001.
If you're on a video or on happened to make it on a TV show, because there wasn't really an outdoor channel at that time. You know, stuff came on TNN or... Man, that was a huge deal back then.
Yeah, so Jeff had made Fallen Skies 1. He was producing Fallen Skies 2. He had an agreement with Realtree Outdoors to produce the footage, so we had to wear Realtree camo when we went out. I was a natural gear fan at the time, being in, you know, western Kansas with no trees. So that was a nice brown tone that seemed to work well. So I dug up Realtree stuff. We went out. After the shoot, they were shooting some B-roll. Him sitting up out of the blind, looking down his barrel and whatever, while I snapped a few pictures with my Canon camera while they were filming it. And since we were working for that sporting goods store, me and the owner of that store, John Lang, ended up going out to Vegas that year for the SHOT Show. I think we had been to Florida the year before, to Orlando, and it was in Vegas this year. And so we went out. I took a copy of the pictures with me, and basically gave them to Jeff when I saw him, and took a picture at the SHOT Show of the cover of Fallen Skies 2, so I could go back and tell everybody, hey, look, I'm going to be in this video. Well, the next thing I know, the video cover changed, and either Jeff's wife or Jeff or somebody from Foil sent me a copy of it, and on the front cover of it, the front cover had changed, and the picture of him looking down his gun barrel that I took was on the front cover, and on the back cover was our group photo with our birds on there. So I had made the cover of a DVD. There was no, that's, you know, there was really no, I at least I didn't have access to the Outdoor Channel or Sportsman's Channel at that time. So I don't think, I'm 99% sure Sportsman's Channel hasn't started at that point, because we ended up seeing it at one of the SHOT Shows that we went to, and I think it was the third year. But anyways, yeah, so for the younger guys, that was kind of it.
I'll do this podcast a disservice if I don't ask this, because I've already asked Jeff. But Jeff at the time, what was he like? I mean, he admitted it, what he was like on my podcast, but what was he like when he back then, when he's on top of the world?
You know, I know Jeff pretty well. Not super great, but I've talked to Jeff, you know, off and on since about 2000.
Yeah, I'm going to find out. Y'all are going to share a lot of similarities.
Yeah. Jeff was always a great guy to me. He never was arrogant. He never didn't take the time to take a phone call. He never, I mean, and he may have, but I didn't know it. I mean, to
but
this day,
killer.
If I got off, he is the killer. And there's that's interesting that you say that, because that statement right there got me in a significant amount of trouble. And it was a leading statement to a lot of the feds' questions later on in my life. And at one point I took Chris Brackett on turkey hunts and deer hunts, and I made the statement to him, you know, there's a difference between a hunter and a killer. I used to make that statement all the time. There's a difference between a hunter and a killer. And the other statement I made a lot is there's a time to hunt and then there's a time to kill shit, basically. I mean, there's a time to sit there and look at things and watch the beauty of it, and then there's a point when the turkey's standing 80 yards away in the timber and he's not coming any closer. And so at this point, you've got to make a decision. You've got to get up and go kill him or whatever. But the hunting him part and the beauty of it, and sitting there chilled out, that part's over. There's a time to hunt stuff, and there's time to kill stuff. So it's funny that you say that. But as far as his attitude towards people, it was great. I was excited to know him. He was, you know, basically the godfather of waterfowl stuff. He had great music to his videos, great messages. He was leading a revolution to show the beauty of waterfowl hunting to people and what they were missing, what it looked like to be laying underneath 400 snow geese that were kept up, tornadoing down on top of you, or, you know, 30 mallards or whatever. I mean, whatever the situation, he captured it on video and brought the beauty into people's living rooms. And he was making people like me see the beauty in it and move forward. And
he,
so it was really hard.
Agree or disagree with this? He was the Midwest Jim Rundquist of the South.
Agree.
Oh, he just,
because we,
yeah.
I mean, he was just, it was inspiring. It was like Kid Rock mixed with, I don't know, the best artist in the world. I mean, you just couldn't put the two. I mean, the two just matched beautifully, perfectly. It was unreal how it was. Like, and I've never told Jeff that. I mean, even as a friend in all of our talks, but he, you know, it was really him and Tim Grounds. So all you young guys out there that are stacking pictures and putting them on Facebook, I mean, Tim Grounds and Jeff Foyles, those are the guys here in the Midwest that were really, they were getting it done. They were bringing the art of hunting into people's living rooms through DVDs and stuff. There was no YouTube stuff at that time. You couldn't watch. It wasn't easy to upload something to where people could watch it. So they were bringing that fire that you feel in your heart. They were bringing that to guys like me and everywhere. I mean, I believe wholeheartedly, and I'll say it time and time again, that guys like those two guys in particular made this industry, this sport, what it is today. And I believe that.
Would you say Belding's kind of taking their place, kind of the king of the Midwest now?
I would say, yeah, probably. Probably.
I mean,
not
in your personal opinion, just in a generalized opinion across the hunting base through the Midwest.
You know, it's funny you say that, because I definitely have resistance to Belding. I don't know why. I don't know why I have that resistance towards Belding, but I do have that resistance towards Belding. I think he's probably an alright guy. I mean, the year after, or 2 years after I started bags, trying to get him out, he came out with a zip tie deal that sold in Cabela's under Banded Gear. And I was okay with it because of the education part, but deep down inside, I'm thinking it's not legal. There's nothing in the law book that says if you zip tie a duck's leg with a purple zip tie, that's not a tag. That's not legally a tagged bird. So anyway, I mean, that's a whole different debate, but.
Well, I'll just say this. Belding is a polarizing figure, man. You love him or you hate him. There's no in between when it comes to Belding.
Well, I guess you can come up with your own conclusion on that, but he himself can probably think where he's at and be thankful for where he's at for guys like Foyles and Tim Grounds.
I agree with that. I fully agree with that.
Whether he'll admit to it or not, and like I said, I don't have any problem with him, but at some point, guys his age, my age, those guys, those fires were lit by the originals.
I agree.
And I talked to Tim Grounds 3 weeks before his accident. I mean, the guys like that are irreplaceable. I mean, he told me, I have so much work to do at my duck club, but I think your product's great. Anybody questions it, have them call me. I'll back it. You're doing the right thing. He said, I've always used freezer paper and like the nylon bale fiber wire or whatever. It's the nylon wrap stuff. And we had a long conversation about it, and he said, I gotta go spray weeds and get ready for season and this and that. And he said, the people don't see the amount of work that goes into it to make a club nice and whatever. And it was a short time after that, we lost him, just a few weeks that we lost him. And it's a bad deal, but he did so much.
I agree, man. He is the godfather that the tree that rooted a lot of branches. A lot.
Yeah.
And look, yeah. Brian, let me ask you this. So you're working at the outdoor store. I think this is where the story gets it really interesting. As we proceed into the kind of the, you need to understand who Ryan was. I mean, was it before Gadden or during Gadden that you became a police officer and almost highway patrolman, right?
Well, at this point, I was working at a store called the Outdoor Edge. I was a co-manager. We were shot showing. We went to Canada with Sean Mann, hunting with Sean Mann. So we were getting pretty heavy into it, and the request for donations. Hey, Pheasants Forever's coming up, Ducks Unlimited, Extreme Fowl, the snack, do you want to donate? We had pit leases all around Kerwin. We were a new store, and so I told my buddy at the time, I said, look, why don't we take some pressure off you? We're spending money on these leases. People want to hunt with us all the time. Let's start a guide service. We'll give away a hunt under the Outdoor Edge, and that's fine. He said, that's fine. You do it. I have my plates full. I said, all right. So I started to try to figure that out, started writing down names. When I was 4 years old, my sister Misty died in a car wreck. There was four people in a vehicle. It wrecked, and she was the only fatality. Everybody else walked away. I never really got to know her, but she was always a big part of my life. And I learned about her through her classmates. She was a senior that year. She was a valedictorian of her class. She had written her speech already. My older sister was 14 at the time. She read her speech for her. My parents stood in line at her graduation. The ropes were obviously passed down, and they brought the ropes to my mom, put them around my mom's neck. So it was a big deal. It was obviously a life-changing event for all of us at age four. I didn't realize it. As I got older, I did and never understood it. Went through my time of questioning God and everything else. And to shorten the story a little bit, the name that I came up with was Misty Morning Outfitters. And I spelled morning, like 9 a.m. type of morning. But to me, Misty Morning Outfitters always meant something different. And I've only told probably 20 to 25 people that prior to this podcast, and most of them were family members. So a lot of people ask me, how did you come up with the name of Misty Morning? And I said, that's
a cool story.
That's how. So that was kind of the deal, and I was proud to take ownership of it. And so we started giving away hunts there. Well, then the sporting goods store didn't make it. I sold traps and could help people with traps and everything else, but the long and the short of it is we just couldn't compete with Walmart. And, you know, we would bring in our turkey selection, we just couldn't compete. And so the store ended up closing after a few years. And at that time, I was seeing a girl and was engaged. And we got married and she got pregnant. And she wanted to move back closer to her family. So I moved from Northwest Kansas up on I-70 where I'd met Jeff and Mike and everybody else. And I moved away from there down towards Wichita to a town called Haven.
It's a ways away.
We had, you know, the guide service part was really just, I mean, I was probably making less than $5,000 a year off of it because most of it was just donated stuff. And so I kind of just tried to let it go and moved down here in August, got on the sheriff's department for Reno County, August 15th of that year, 2005. And the call started in the fall. Hey, are you still guiding? I don't know, not really. Well, can you take me and my cousin? He's going to be in town. Well, I mean, I'm here now. Okay, well, we'll come there, or we'll do this, or we'll do that. So people just started, the demand was still there. I still had a 20-foot trailer with vinyl all over the side, like everybody does that thinks they know what they're doing. And so here we were. I had the blinds. I had, you know, 10 blinds and a trailer full of, you know, 20 dozen decoy full bodies and, you know, some sleeper shells and this and that. And so I had everything that I needed to do. And so I went ahead and said, yeah, you know, my schedule's pretty easy. I'm on three, off two, on two, off three. So I could lay it out and say, yeah, I can take somebody Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or I can take somebody whatever. So I started producing available dates. And those dates continued to book. Well, you know, the first year or two, I booked a handful of people. Well, then as people around Haven and Wichita started realizing that at least he pretends like he knows what he's doing, so maybe we should go with him, then they started trying to book hunt. So I raised my prices a little bit because my availability was going down. And they continued to book, and I continued to fill on my off days. And so then I got my price up there where I was about matching, where I was pretty much matching everybody else in the industry. And I continued to book and was working nights. Me and my wife had our oldest child at that time, and we had just had our second child. That was 3 years later. So Briley and Maisie, my two girls, were born, and things were going pretty well. And I said, hey, why things are going well, do I make this jump or not? And her dad was the chief of police for about 29 years, and so she knew what that lifestyle was like, and I don't think she really wanted to live with it forever, you know, 4 months of nights, 4 months of days. And so I said, here's the opportunity. I can start a mobile drug and alcohol testing business. We'll call it Advanced Mobile Testing because it's in the A's, so they'll find it first when they look it up. And so I kind of knew business, and she said, yeah, let's do it. And so I started doing some mobile drug testing, like on site and stuff like that, and stopped the sheriff's department. And I love that job, but it was not good for a young marriage with a young family. And I knew that, and I knew that I was a long way from making detectives, where it was an 8-to-5 deal. And so I cut back and just started guiding. And so I bought my lodge in Haven and started to remodel it. It was downtown. It was a 2-story building. And I started
Brian,
a complete remodel.
At this point, this is where we're going to stop it today. But at this point in your guiding career, is there anything, listen, 100% transparent. Is there anything that leads the game wardens to your door? Not knowing what you know now, but back then, you were trying to do things 100% right.
I was so sure that I was doing things right that when I went to the police academy, we went with game wardens. And several of them are still my friends today that are throughout the state. And I used to poke at them all the time about, well, when I grew up, if I could do anything, it'd be a game warden, because that or a school teacher, because a school teacher can open a locker and look for drugs with no probable cause. If I come in there, I have to bring a dog. The dog has to alert before I can do that. Otherwise, it's illegal search and seizure. I said, game warden, same way. If you, you're a hunter, well, let me in your house, let me in your truck, let me in this, let me in that. And you can look through whatever you want on the grounds that I hunt. And so I used to, and they were friends of mine, and we had to work together through the academy. And so I poked at them quite a bit. And they knew I was an avid hunter. And so, you know, they would say, how was pheasant season? Hey, man, it was really good. I shot 12 opening day. Well, the limit's 4. And they knew that. And then I'm like, I got into them real thick the second day because I just stayed in the truck and shot them out the window. And I ended up getting 16 on the second day. And so, I mean, I badgered them all the time, and, you know, they would ask me how deer season was, and I told them, you know, it was great, but I had this huge mule deer, like, right 50 yards. I waited, everything turned perfect. He turned broadside. I had him right in the crosshairs, flipped the safety, go to squeeze, and the spotlight went out. And of course, they're like, warden, whatever. They always called me warden by my last name. They're like, oh, warden, you're so full of it, and this and that. And I'm like, yeah, but you suckers were listening, weren't you? So, I mean, it was always a good relationship. I had no reason to believe they were coming. In my 5 years of law enforcement, we backed them up. We backed all the game wardens up to the state lakes. I ate lunch with them. I mean, we were all out working together, so it was like, you know, my badge was 432. One of the guys was 1432, and I would call him and ask him if, you know, on the radio and say, you want a 1021 for break for 1010, and he'd say yeah, and we'd meet and eat lunch and how things going good, and, you know, they might transfer me, and so, I mean, I had
what.
It was great.
I guess what I'm getting at, Ryan.
I mean, I would tell him with me.
Not once when you walked out of your house to guide a hunt, not one single time did you go out, oh man, we're going to shoot a couple extra today. Or when somebody said, hey man, can we shoot yours too? Because that's always the famous question with the guide service. Can we shoot your limit too? It was always no, right?
Never once. Now, I'm going to say this in complete honesty. To a certain extent, party hunting goes on with most people. When there's 6 guys sitting in a blind, you and 5 of your high school classmates sitting in a blind, and you have, you know, you can kill 6 ducks each. You can kill 36 ducks. When you set up and dump, and I asked the feds this question at one point, when you set up and dump 3 rounds from 6 guys, there's 18 rounds, 150 pellets out of a round, you dump into a group of birds coming, and you don't know who's shooting what, how can you tell me who killed what? So we tried to just say, hey, we've got, you know, that was 7 Mallard Drakes and 3 hens, and we divided those up. You know, and because otherwise, inevitably, you stood there and argued with a client. And probably my biggest mistake, and note to self, to all you outfitters out there, I know you're doing it because you love it, but if you can avoid shooting with your clients, that's the number one tip you can take away from here today. Do not shoot with your clients. Then there's no question of, did you shoot 7 and they shot 5 or whatever. And that's exactly how they got grounds. That's how the feds got grounds, and we've talked about it. They shot blanks and allowed 10 grounds to shoot their limit, basically. And then they charged him with shooting over the limit. So, number one thing, I know it's hard, don't shoot. And so we were kind of at that time moving to where the guides only shot cripples. But still, you can ask 20 feds and state game wardens tomorrow, if Bob hits a bird and it's coasting down and I shoot it and finish it off, who kills it? Who killed it, who tags it, who takes possession of that bird. And you're going to have a split in answers, I guarantee it.
Never get a straight answer on that one.
No. So best advice I can give you, don't shoot. It's hard, but don't shoot.
You're right.
And you're a lot of those guys like Sean Mann, he didn't shoot with us in Canada. I couldn't figure out why. He set his layout 20 yards behind us and called. And then he called the shot when they were over the top of the sun. I thought, is he just tired of shooting geese or what now? Hindsight looking back, we went on that hunt in 2001, I think. Hindsight looking back, that's exactly what it was. It wasn't he was too shy of shooting them. He was smart enough to know that you don't shoot with clients. When there's 7 other people laying in front of you, you don't shoot, because either you're arguing with the client. No, I shot that one for sure. And inevitably, the one you think you shot that you're going to claim is going to have a band on it.
Ooh.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
And the other five clients are going to say, well, they're going to call their wife, well, I shot this one. It's clear over on the right side. But I knew it. I knew it when it came in because I could see its leg hanging down there. I could see a little flash. And so, sure enough, I shot it. And the guy... Bam. It's just not worth it.
Well, Ryan, look, next week, the man cometh, and you don't know it. But before we get into that, we're going to get into the why. I want to know the why. Looking back on it now, why? Why did he come? You're going to tell us that why. Next week, because yeah. I think it's a interesting one. There's a couple of different opinions maybe on why, but I think it's one, you know, they both should be heard, you know, by the people that are listening to this. Ryan, I know you got to get to what, gymnastics? I've got to get to a T-ball game.
We got volleyball tonight. We got
volleyball.
Competitive volleyball, the final tournament. Tonight, remember that girl that was born that brought me back to Haven?
Yeah.
Where I met my demise? She's in volleyball tonight.
How old is she now?
She is 13.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And the second girl is 10. Both play competitive volleyball and competitive softball. One of them got second this weekend in softball, and one of them got whipped.
I hope that by listening to this today, that, look, I'm not out to try to prove that the feds are out to get everybody. I'm out to prove that there's guys out here trying to do it right. Really, honestly, wake up every day trying to do this the right way. And still get busted for something. And that's what I'm trying to get across. through these podcasts. I can't wait till next week, Ryan. It should be really good, because you and I have spent a lot of time on next week's episode talking about it. Look, I appreciate you being here today. We want to thank all of you that listened to this edition of the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.